For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so if you're here to hear Mark Baer, you need to start walking. However, you will still hear quite a bit about C.S. Lewis if that's why you wanted to listen to Mark Baer, because he does come up quite a bit here. So I'm Donal O'Mahuna, and I'd just like to start with a word of prayer. Lord, we thank you for the opportunity to be here, for the great teachings that we've been listening to, for the conversations, the insights, the way that you've been touching us. And I just really pray, God, that you would use this session to bring up issues that you want each one of us to reflect on, and to really encourage us to look at this dimension of how you can use us as we seek to understand and to reach out to the culture around us. Amen. Well, I know some of you very well, and I don't know others of you at all. I am Irish originally, and came to the U.S. about 30 years ago or so to study at Ohio State. I did my PhD there. And along the way, became a Christian through getting involved in Xenos. And in at that time, my PhD was in pharmacy, so in the sciences. And through getting involved in Xenos, I became really interested in the ethics of science, medicine, healthcare. And more and more over the years, that has become my focus, ethics of healthcare and technology. And about 13 years or so ago, God started bringing some people into our lives, kind of saying, well, what about going back to Ireland? And so 10 years ago, we did move back, and that's where we're based now, and have traveled over. We still stay connected in with Xenos at all possible where we can. But along the way, then, as I've been teaching ethics, this kind of brings me to the focus of today's talk. And in teaching ethics, there is a lot of interest, as you can imagine, in the reasons, the arguments, the logic that goes into formulating ethical positions on various issues. But there's also a lot of evidence coming out that in spite of all sorts of ethics courses, in spite of ethics codes and ethics committees, people will know the right thing to do and still do something else. And so this question keeps coming up about what is it that takes a person from knowing the right thing to actually doing it, and even beyond that, to wanting to do the right thing. And so because of that, there's a lot of interest then in how does reason and emotion interplay with one another? What role does how you feel about a patient or how you feel about an issue play in the way you interact on what you think is right and what you think is wrong? And that's where I've been doing a lot of reading, exploring in my teaching at Dublin City University. And when I saw the theme for this year's conference, I thought, you know, there's a way that all of this, I think, can apply in the area of apologetics, because we don't want people to know the arguments about why we think God exists or how others can bring up arguments about why we think he doesn't exist. We want to get into the whole area of actually believing that, of committing to that, to those ideas, or of actively following out and going where those issues really lead. And we've heard quite a bit at the conference about the reasons for belief, about the arguments that can be brought up, about the way that logic is involved in those arguments. And I do not in any way disagree with those arguments and those positions. I'm not here as a postmodernist to tell you that if you just feel good about the arguments, then that's great, and if you don't, then, well, you know, we'll just leave it there and agree to have different stories about how we approach life. But what I do want to bring up is that I think there's an important place for emotion as we engage with these issues, that there's an important way that I think emotional factors play a major role in why people may believe the arguments that we have been dismantling and may see the logical incoherence of them or the contradictions in them and still refuse to look seriously at the Christian claim for life. And I also believe that there's a lot behind the way the world is, that there is a lot in the world that leads to emotional reactions, and that those are part of what we can capture to engage people in thinking about, well, could God be the one behind the reasons why we feel this way about nature, or why people can be so moved by a piece of film, can be so engaged in a video game, and ways that maybe we can be tapping into those sources of experiences and use them to lead people towards the reasons that we think God explains all of those parts of life, not just the reason and the arguments. But the whole issue of reason and emotion has a long history of being separated out, that the area within philosophy and some areas of theology has been really set up as a real dichotomy between these issues. I need to cover a couple of these slides first before I get into that area. In terms of my own exploring of this issue in ethics, there is a realization that emotion plays an important role here. And so we have one book about medical ethics, which points out that ethical decision-making is a complicated process of using all of one's faculties, intellect, emotions, and imagination, to evaluate a particular situation and determine how to act. And so there's this interest in looking at where emotions and imagination play a role in ethical decision-making. Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, pointed out that if arguments were in themselves enough to make men good, they would justly have won very great rewards. But as things are, they are not able to encourage the many to nobility and to goodness. And I think we saw some of that in the interactions that we've heard from John Lennox and Bill Craig, that people can see these arguments and still decide that they're not going to be convinced by them, even though they're logical. And what Martha Nussbaum, I think, has been pointing out in her work on literature and philosophy is that to be fully successful as arguments, arguments must be such as to change the heart. And where do we then engage with people in around these arguments on the issues of the heart? I think this is something that is really important to the Lord as well. When an expert in law came to Jesus and said, well, okay, I'm ready to commit to you, Jesus. What do I need to do to inherit eternal life? Jesus replied, what is written in the law? How do you read it? And he answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind. Oh, and love your neighbor as yourself. And so what I want to talk about is, where are we engaging people with issues of the heart, the soul, and the strength, as well as the mind? Because they, I think, all play a particular role. And I'll also mention very briefly at the end that that second commandment is also important, to love your neighbor as yourself, because action plays a role in all of this as well. But my focus is going to be on the first parts of the heart and the imagination. I forgot to mention as well, there's extra handouts are now available, so if anybody needs those, Chris is going around with a big pile if you want to put your hand up and she'll bring you something. So the Lord is concerned about our minds and about a lot of other factors. And this is where C.S. Lewis comes into my presentation, because he was also concerned about the role of the imagination, as he has come up regularly throughout the conference in terms of the ways he has contributed to apologetics. But he originally himself was always was a philosopher of literature, and he really engaged a lot with literature and the imagination. He called the imagination the organ of meaning. When we are wondering, what is this all about? What does this mean? How do we understand the reasons for why we live and why the world is the way it is? That then we're engaging our imagination. as one of the scholars who has is an authority on Lewis at the moment, Michael Ward, said, before we act or think, we understand meaning, in Lewis's view. And so the provision of meaningful images becomes the hallmark of his apologetic method. When you look at his books and articles and contrast them with other apologists, he has all sorts of metaphors, similes, examples, stories embedded into all of his work. I think we saw a really good example of that this morning with John Lennox. The part of what made his lecture so engaging were the stories that he was able to thread in throughout that, and I think in that way he's following the method that Lewis really emphasized. Lewis himself, in his book Surprised by Joy, talks about two highly significant events or factors in his journey towards the Lord. He was a rationalist, he was an atheist, he was convinced about the importance of the mind and arguments and logic. But two things that really turned him to really actively consider Christ, one of them was a fairy tale, and the other was a walk in the morning one time, in a misty, foggy morning. And the impact that those two things had on him were hugely significant. It took him 15 years to eventually make his commitment to the Lord. But it was the way that those things triggered emotional reactions, led his imagination to start to wander into areas that he had not wanted to go before, that eventually led him to accept Christ. And he talks regularly then about the importance of this in apologetics, and gives us really good examples of how to do that. Many others have mentioned this type of thing. George Bernard Shaw is a playwright who said, you use a glass mirror to see your face. You use works of art to see the soul. And again, it's the piece of art, the painting, the film, the video game, I would say, are a modern form of art in some ways, that these can trigger reactions within us, emotional reactions, trigger our imagination, get our creative juices going, and these can give us some insight into the way that we are made, what our soul is like. And as an example, I think I picked up this postcard when I was in Singapore and got to visit a museum for some of the Japanese prisoner of war camps that they had. The way a pen and pencil drawing that was made during by one of the soldiers that was held captive in this camp captures, I think, so much of what humanity is about. These prisoners, each one of them probably emaciated at the point of death, possibly, and yet here, two of them can still see the importance of helping a third man to just get around. There's all sorts of different things caught up in that little picture that could get us to start to talk about things, to imagine things, to wonder, you know, what must that really be like? And so I think something as simple as a drawing like that can capture things. And likewise, I think this is where movies, songs, video games can also play a role. And so I want to kind of get you thinking about this area by looking at a clip from a film. This film is also from a Japanese prisoner of war camp in World War II. And the British soldiers have been figuring out how do they actually cope with the terrible treatment that they have been given. How are they going to manage with all of this? How are they going to keep their own humanity when they are being treated in a completely inhumane way? And towards the end of the movie, this ability to hold on to their own humanity confronts them, because the Allied bombers have passed by very close by and bombed another Japanese military barracks. And some of the surviving Japanese soldiers from that bombing show up at the gates of the concentration camp. And the question is, what are they going, these British soldiers, how are they going to interact with these other wounded Japanese soldiers? So as we watch this clip, I'd like you just to engage with what you're seeing, just to look at it. And then what I'd like to have a short discussion about, what sorts of feelings were triggered by this film? What, how were you left to feel as you engaged with what's going on here?
An enemy location was also hit nearby. The wounded had abandoned their posts looking for help. Their arrival at our camp would compel us to make the most important decision of our lives. A decision that would defy the Bushido code of honor and shame.
Captain Gordon, I forbid you to give comfort and aid to the enemy.
Major, those are wounded, dying human beings. They're no harm to us.
Ernie, get back to your own men.
Someone please get me some water. Could someone please get me some water?
Willing to take the risk and share how were you feeling while you were watching that? Somebody back here? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Anything else? Pardon? Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's this area of power, of beauty, of conflicted feelings, and in all of this, it's like, well, if we can get those things to bring to come forward, that maybe we can have an opportunity to talk about something, something deep, something meaningful, that presenting somebody an article about the philosophical arguments for why love your enemies is a good position to take. It's another way of engaging with this dimension of the reality that we are trying to put out there as part of the reality of life with God, of God's universe being put together in a certain type of way. And so this is what I want to get at today. I'm going to bring up a variety of different types of media, of art, that some of you may look at and you may think, what on earth is that all about? And have no reaction whatsoever. And the same person beside you may be thinking, wow, that is meaningful. So we'll hopefully get a smattering of different types of media and art that will satisfy each of you in some particular way. But don't worry if you aren't moved by all of it. So what we're going against here, though, is a trend in philosophy that is in some ways very similar to the trend that we've been talking about with science and scientism and the Enlightenment. In terms of within philosophy, going back much longer, there has been this emphasis on rationality. That Plato, for example, talked about the human soul being divided into three different categories. The rational soul, which was your head, where you did your thinking. The impulsive soul, your passions, your heart for stuff, where you felt things. And then your appetitive soul, where you just had these instincts and these gut reactions that you wanted to do certain things. But in his philosophy, the rational soul was the one that needed to be in control of everything else. Developing on from him, there came the view within Greek thought of the upstairs and the downstairs. The upstairs was where you had the control, the rational thought, the logic. The downstairs was where you had your emotions, your passions, and the upstairs needed to control and dominate and take over the downstairs part. Within Enlightenment philosophy in the 18th century, Immanuel Kant is one of the philosophers who's best known in the area of ethics. He really emphasized the importance of rationally thinking through our ethical positions. But he points out that the principle of apathy, according to which the wise man must never succumb to emotion, and he goes on and talks about how this includes when your best friend is hurting, of not being moved by that, but instead remaining firm to your rational thought. He says that is the correct and sublime moral principle of the Stoic school, for emotion makes a person more or less blind. Emotions are the bad stuff that take us off in the wrong direction. They're the things that we have to squelch. And when I first became a Christian, I agreed completely with this. I'd never really thought about it a whole lot. But I was convinced that these emotions just get in the way of good science, they get in the way of a happy life. And then I got married, and my wife will tell you that I spent the first 6 months of our marriage trying to convince her that emotions are bad. If she would turn those off, our marriage would be much more happy. We would get along so much better. And by the time we ended up in front of a counselor, Then I started to wonder, well, you know, maybe there is something else to these emotions. And it did take some convincing. But I have to say that one of the things that convinces me of the reality of God is the way that he has changed me completely in the area of emotion, to where I've come to realize, even in preparing for this talk, that, boy, I have all these emotions inside of me. And he is helping me to develop those, to engage with them appropriately in the way that he has made me. And that this is a wonderful part of the human being. This is part of the beauty of the way he has made us. And what I think is actually even more remarkable is that God himself has emotions. Scripture is full about the way that God feels towards human beings. About the desire that he has for good to be in them, for the joys that he wants us to have, and for the anger that he gets when he sees the way that we treat others or the way that we engage with him, but that this is an emotional God. Part of the influence of the Greek philosophy and the Platonic idea was that God was an idea. God was just thought and mind. and that this was a thinking God who just thinks about thinking, that that's as far as this great ideal actually goes. And so that it is a very impersonal view of what God is. And instead, what we see in Scripture is a very personal God who is engaged in emotions. Abraham Heschel is a Jewish scholar who's written a book called The Prophets, and it looks at the Old Testament and the way that emotion and what he calls pathos is threaded throughout this. He says that the source of evil is not in passion, in the throbbing heart, but rather in hardness of heart, in callousness and insensitivity. The biblical writers frequently regard some emotions or passions as having been inspired, as reflections of the higher power. The utterances of the psalmist are charged with emotion, are outpourings of emotion. Reading the prophets, we're stirred by their passion and enlivened imagination. Their primary aim is to move the soul, to engage the attention by bold and striking images, and therefore it is to the imagination and the passions that the prophets speak, rather than aiming at the cold approbation of the mind. So you picture images of the bones coming together and marching along in the valleys. All sorts of other engaging images of the wrath of God, but of the love of God, of the passion that he has for people and for what's good for them. And so I think part of the challenge to each of us then is, how are we using images to engage the world with what God is like? How are we using analogies or word pictures? How are we looking and portraying the passions that God has out there? Again, another example, you look up at the stars and you just see different balls of gas that are in flame, or different massive pieces of rock that are drifting around, or instead, as the psalmist says, the heavens tell of the glory of God, the skies display his marvelous craftsmanship. Day after day they continue to speak, night after night they make him known. They speak without a sound or a word. And this is part of the natural world that is around us. Are we tapping into these the speaking without sounds or words that can capture our imagination and draw us up and think, wow, what is it that brought this all into being? How can we engage with this amazing universe in a way that acknowledges how exactly it is? We then turn to Jesus Christ, and we see him crying, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who killed the prophets and stoned those sent to you. How often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing." The feeling that's in that. The chicken, again, the image of a mother hen gathering her chicks, taking care of her, as an example of what God wants to do with each and every one of us. And yet, we were not willing. The sadness that goes with that. The most remarkable example, then, I think we have, is of Jesus showing up at the funeral of Lazarus. The creator of the world, the master of the universe, and he stands there and he cries. That's the God that we worship, that we have had the privilege of coming to know. And are we able to communicate this passionate, emotional side of Christ as we engage with others? Have we caught on to it in ourselves? You know, I just came from here to hear from Gary's discussion about information technology. And I think part of the problem with an overload of technology is that we don't take the time to sit and feel what this verse is saying. That we don't feel, we don't reflect on the way that the world is, because we see a picture and we flip right on into the next one. And I think in that, we're missing out on an important dimension of how God is communicating with all of us, and then also an important way that we can engage and connect with those around us. Maybe there's somebody who just can't get these rational arguments, who doesn't care whether it's logical or not. But can you grab on to some of these imaginative things that maybe would grab their heart? Maybe a powerful image that leaves them happy or sad or overwhelmed or amazed. And can say, well, let's talk about that part of the way the world is. How do you explain that with whatever else it is that that you might believe? So where do video games fit in here? Well, I think if you're not convinced yet that emotion is out there, and emotion is kind of getting at us in lots of ways. I was watching the release of the new Xbox One, and when they came to talk about the next version of the big game Call of Duty, I was astonished by how much emotional language was in the way they portrayed this game. This big war game, this manly macho way of destroying the world or saving the world and everything else. And yet, it's all about the emotions that go with it. So I want you to listen to a little bit of this. The other thing to remember is that after they talk about the way this new version of the game has been made, they get the CEO of Activision, the company that has made this, comes out and talks a little bit more about it. But the other side of all of this is the largest, most profitable franchise in all of entertainment. Not just among video games, all of entertainment. And we'll see what it is that that these guys are doing. We'll look at a couple of minutes of this.
Here at Infinity Ward, we've had a great time crafting the benchmark of the modern day shooter on current gen. And we're really excited that we get to be the studio that brings Call of Duty into the next generation. We have a whole new story with brand new characters, completely new world, and this is powered by a new next gen engine that gives us amazing graphic fidelity and really innovative new ways to play the game. So what we wanted to do is create a cast of characters that you really felt more emotionally attached to. We had the opportunity to work with Steven Gagan. This is the guy that won an Oscar for writing Traffic. He wrote and directed Syriana.
What they really wanted in this game, in Call of Duty Ghosts, is they wanted emotional reality. They wanted these characters to feel real, to feel like real people.
So the story opens up with a mass event. America is crippled, our military forces are devastated, our government's in disarray, and as the player, you are actually the underdog, fighting back against these superior forces. So the team you're a part of is formed from the remnants of all the US special forces.
Ghosts are a super elite fighting force, to like the Spartans all the way through SEAL Team 6. They've adopted every technique that's useful for modern, urban, guerrilla-style fighting.
One of the fascinating new additions to your squad is a dog. We've had dogs in Call of Duty before, but never like this. This is someone you care about. This is a squad member. He does everything from sniffing out explosives to protecting the team. So with this next Call of Duty, being in a new world, on a whole new storyline, one of the things that we wanted to do to support that was create a new engine.
Our goal this game is to make brand new next-gen characters and weapons that's never been seen before in a Call of Duty game. We have a new tech in the game, Sub-D. The idea is the closer you get to it, the more it tries to maintain any curvature that you see. This is very helpful on weapons, helmets for characters, and it makes a huge difference for visual fidelity, what the player sees from a distance as well as close-up.
With a new next-gen console, this is an opportune time for us to reinvent the experience that we deliver. It's important to keep our core philosophies about gameplay drives tech.
So when I think about the animation features that we've been working on for Call of Duty Ghosts, one of the first things that come to mind is immersion. We have a new mantle system so that when you're running quickly and you hit a wall, you get this nice boom, you hit it and you leap and you go and you just maintain your momentum. And we have the lean feature that allows you to lean out and lean in and you get a better view of the battlefield. So another feature that we're working on with animation is the slide. It allows you to get somewhere quickly, get out of the line of fire, and at the same time do it in a really cool looking way.
We've added fluid dynamics, interactive smoke, and also added an AI system to it. So we have fish move out of the way when you get close to them.
The poly counts, the texture increases, the shaders, the lighting tech, the level should feel like you're really there, and all the technology that's going into it allows you to achieve those goals.
With this being an all-new Call of Duty, we've really taken this opportunity to revamp multiplayer. One of these new MP features that I'm most excited about is dynamic maps. We have everything from big earthquakes and floods down to player-driven actions. Doors, explosive traps, things that change the flow of the map. All of this creates a new dynamic experience for the player. Another new feature is character customization. You can choose the heads, you can choose the bodies, you can choose the helmet and gear that you're wearing. You can connect with who you are as a player more so than we've ever done in the past. Dynamic maps and character customization are just two of the new innovations that we're bringing to next-gen multiplayer. We have the best fans in the world, and we're committed to creating for them a new next-generation Call of Duty experience. One of the key reasons Call of Duty has been as successful as it is we focus on gameplay. It's the thing we design for. It's the thing that drives our success as a franchise. And with all of the new tech, all of the new story elements, everything that we're putting into this next-generation Call of Duty, we are still 60 frames a second, low-latency controls, a great-feeling game.
This will be the most beautiful Call of Duty game we've ever made. It will also be the most character-driven and emotionally engaging Call of Duty game we've ever made. And it will be the best Call of Duty game we've ever made. A stunning leap forward, not just for this franchise, but also for console gaming. To show you what I...
Okay, so the world knows that emotional engagement is really crucial. You know, maybe you're really tied into these games and you've never really wondered why it is. Well, these games are appealing to your heart. They're getting in there and engaging with you on this emotional level. And we need to think and reflect about that. But I think it also is a reflection of the reality of the way that we have been made, that taking care of our emotional side is really important. That we need to be aware of where our heart has been taken with the various things that we are being exposed to, but then also looking to see how can we use this as an opportunity to engage with other people. Why do you find it so satisfying? Why do you care so much about the dog in this video game and we can't get you out to help with our roommate or something like that? So again, there is this realization out in the world that emotional engagement is extremely important and a way to bring people into engagement with these sorts of issues. This is not a new realization. After the Enlightenment got going, there was a reaction among some of the cultural elite, which became known as Romanticism. These were people who were saying there is more to the world than science, and it led to an emphasis on a lot of poetry, music, art. And John Keats was a poet who wrote a lot of really engaging material. But I think in one of the last lines of one of his poems, he captured this idea as well, that beauty is truth, truth, beauty. The Enlightenment was saying that the only way you can find truth is through science and reason. And yet in beauty, there is a picture of truth. There is a way to see something beautiful and engage with the reality of that. This is part of, I think, what the Enlightenment rationalism was so dangerous about. It came and gave the impression that the only things that were real were the physical world and the things that science could show you, the things you could put in a bottle and do an experiment on or verify materially. And yet there is truth in the world that is not verifiable scientific, and yet it is still very important. C.S. Lewis, as I mentioned, said that one of the things that really got him to think differently out of his rationalism was going for a walk one day in a misty, foggy morning. He said, "At that very moment, there arose the memory of a place and time at which I had tasted the lost joy with unusual fullness. It had been a particular hill walk on a morning of white mist. That walk I now remembered. It seemed to me that I had tasted heaven then." This is an atheist who didn't believe in anything beyond the world, and yet he's saying, "I tasted heaven." This is the sort of truth that beauty and experiences can start us to touch with. It led him to start to wonder, what is this experience I've got? If only such a moment could return. And he spent all sorts of numbers of years trying to get this feeling back again. And it wasn't then until later that he started to read George MacDonald's fairy tale called Phantasties that he started to see, it's a spiritual world that I'm actually seeking after. And so there was a lot of romantic art that was made at the time, where the idea was to capture this sense of heaven or sense of another world, that there is something about nature that draws us towards this, that this is not just a big pile of stone. This is something amazing that we need to think about. Again, there was a lot of this art that, or some of it was pictured the human just wondering about nature, looking out on the foggy coastline and kind of wondering, what is this all about? What is it? Alistair McGrath has written this book on apologetics, which is the most unusual one that I've ever read, because unlike most apologetics books, it's got lots of pictures. And what he's done in this book is talk about this feeling that we have, this longing for something else. He says, deep down, many of us long for something that's really worthwhile. While we're looking for something that really matters, there seems to be something about human nature that makes it want to long for something life-changing. While many people are troubled by the thought of dying, others are disturbed by a much more profound anxiety that we might die without having really begun to live. We get this sense there's something bigger about my life than simply the physical dimension. How do we tap into this? Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was spent many years in a concentration camp in Soviet Russia, but he was a writer, but he says that not everything has a name. Some things lead us into a realm without words. Art warms even an icy and depressed heart, opening it to lofty spiritual experience. By means of art, we are sometimes sent, dimly, briefly, revelations unattainable by reason. Like that little mirror in the fairy tales, look into it and you will see, not yourself, but for a moment, that which surpasses understanding, a realm to which no man can ride or fly, and for which the soul begins to ache. C.S. Lewis says that's what George MacDonald's fairy tale did for him. This was just this man's wandering through a fairy world, and just this longing for this beautiful little blue flower that he was searching for this lovely world that he didn't see around him. He had just come back from fighting in World War I. The world looked like a terrible place to him at that time. And yet this fairy tale brought him to a place that there is something more to this life than the mess that we have to live in. Music these days, I think, is capturing some of this. And again, what I think we need to do is engage with the feelings that sometimes music elicits. So why don't you listen to this song then and see what sorts of ways it engages with you.
Don't got a lot of time, don't give a damn. Don't tell me what to do, I'm the man. If there's a God up there, something above, God, shine your light down here, shine on the love, love of the loveless, love of the loveless. Don't have too many friends, never felt at home, always been my own man, pretty much alone. I know how to get through, and when push comes to shove, I got something that you need. I got the love, love of the loveless, love of the loveless, love of the loveless, the love of the loveless. All around you, people walking into hearts and voices. God, shine your light down here. Shine on the love, love of the loveless. Love of the loveless. Love of the loveless.
Share any feelings you got during that one? Mm-hmm. In the back there? Hopelessness, yeah. Yeah. Can you say it a little louder? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a part of us which where we know, you know, if we know anybody who's out there drinking regularly, just getting drunk, whether it's the weekends or just sort of like we know, well, why are you doing that? But I think sometimes music captures the feeling of hopelessness. I think part of that constant drum is part of the way musicians design music to get at those feelings of it's depressing, it's sad, and yet it's just humdrum, it's just the way things go. Yeah, you had isolation, yeah. Yeah. And so I think we all have different reactions to different pieces of music and that, but I think there's a way of grasping at these sorts of things. Maybe then, and then I think we need to take these feelings and emotional reactions that we get and then start to reflect on them. That's what I want to move on into talking about, is that I'm not saying that we just need to feel the stuff that's around us, that we also need to engage with critical reflection about the things that we feel. And so maybe we're struggling with, you know, well, why bother going out and reaching out to some of these people that, you know, I know they're into self-destructive behavior and they won't listen to any rational arguments that we will give them about changing their lives and stuff like that. But to hear a piece of music, I think, capture that feeling of hopelessness. I don't know how many dozens of times I've listened to that piece recently preparing for today, and it still moves me to realize I have friends like that. What am I doing to try and connect with them at the level at which they're at, to be able to find a way to share with them or to give them a glimpse at something that might help to pull them out of this? Now, maybe you're an Eels fan and you know this song, and you've got friends you can talk about with this about this particular lyric. But maybe not. Maybe this sort of music just does nothing for you. But I would guess that many of us spend hours listening to music probably every day. Do you think about the lyrics that are going on there? Are you listening to the messages that you're being fed? And are you also reflecting on, where are there lyrics in here? Where are there sensations? Where are there feelings that I can talk to Johnny or Mary or my friends at school or wherever. Did you catch what was in that song? I know you love this band or that group or this singer or whatever. Did you catch the way that that makes me feel? That gives me a sense of hopelessness or a sense of joy, a sense of the world is bigger than just me and you, or engaging with people on this level. And similarly then with movies that you go and see, do you kind of come out of those and think, oh, that was great, you know, wasn't it great to see that hunk there or that beautiful woman and all this sort of thing? Or are you talking about the ways that, you know, they brought up a really profound issue in there, or that disgusted me the way that that character was treating somebody else? And then using these as an opportunity to connect with people, connect with the culture, and then to be able to engage with some deeper issues and lead into where those sensations may be coming from, where they may be influenced by beliefs, where somebody may be kind of thinking, yeah, I don't understand why I feel bad when I look at this thing or hear this thing. And maybe it's that their conscience is getting at them, maybe the spirit is calling out to them on a particular issue, and that you may be able to then lead them along in that journey. Now, there is a response to these sensations that we get. John Lennox talked about this a little bit in Alistair McGrath's book. He spends quite a while examining this argument, what he calls the great projection theory, that can be traced back to Freud, that basically, as well, the way Freud put it, is that we shall tell ourselves that it would be very nice if there were a God who created the world and an afterlife. These religious ideas, which are given out as teachings, are illusions, fulfillments of the oldest, strongest, and most urgent wishes of mankind. So we look at a beautiful sunset and we think, boy, there must be something bigger than us. And Freud would say that that's just a feeling you get. There's really nothing there. It's you have a longing for a life where you get to just sit and enjoy the sunsets every day. Or these other feelings of sadness. It's just that you just need to get over the fact the world is meaningless, you know, put up with it. But part of the issue with this argument is that it actually solves or goes against and undermines any belief in anything. As McGrath says, the great projection theory is a double-edged sword which can wound those who use it as much as those against whom it is used. For the theory threatens to prove too much, that all our beliefs rest on hidden longings. Might our sense of emptiness and lack of fulfillment be intended to point us to something or someone who could fulfill it? This has also been put in in terms of the God-shaped hole that we have. Yeah, maybe it is simply a longing, as Freud would put it, but also could it be that there is a God-shaped void within us, that we are seeking after heaven, that we have this craving for a home like heaven, because that is the way that we have been created, and that there is such a home that we can move towards, that we have a thirst because there is something that can quench that thirst, and it is in the spiritual area. So that is part then of what Lewis started to reflect on, and he said that there is this whole area of story that is in literature and many other forms of art that he calls myth. But he says a myth is a type of story that arouses in us sensations we have never had before, never anticipated having, as though we had broken out of our normal mode of consciousness and possessed joys not promised to our birth. It gets under our skin, hits us at the deeper level than our thoughts or even our passions, troubles oldest certainties till all questions are reopened, and in general shocks us more fully awake than we are for most of our lives. So he says there's this type of story or experience that fairy tales get to us about this, or beautiful pictures, sometimes music and that, and it just causes us to think about these bigger things. So For some, this can be a piece of art, but this one just has always spoken strongly to me, because down at the bottom there is the guy trying to climb up onto this ledge, and as soon as he gets up and has a look, and he realizes, you know, look how much further I still have to go. And this just captures for me some of the ways that the life feels like when I'm in the middle of trying to accomplish anything. But there are different ways then that a piece of art can capture this. And so this is what is being done in many ways around us in modern entertainment as well. There are ways that there is a fantasy world is being put out there and is painting a vision of the way that life in the world could be. And we need to reflect on what this is and the messages that are going along with that. So this is a video game, Deus Ex, that some of you may be familiar with. It's about the various characters get enhancements in order to be able to complete various missions. And then at the end, there is the winner gets to send out this video that kind of explains what all has been going on and the vision for the world that that he has. And so this is the message that that this particular character puts out there. Is the problem with the sound on my end?
Seraph was right about one thing. It's in our nature to want to rise above our limits. Think about it. We were cold, so we harnessed fire. We were weak, so we invented tools. Every time we met an obstacle, we used creativity and ingenuity to overcome it. The cycle is inevitable. But will the outcome always be good? I guess that will depend on how we approach it. These past few months, I was challenged many times. But more often than not, didn't I try to keep morality in mind, knowing that my actions didn't have to harm others? Time and time again, didn't I resist the urge to abuse power and resources simply to achieve my goals more swiftly? In the past, we've had to compensate for weaknesses, finding quick solutions that only benefit a few. But what if we never need to feel weak or morally conflicted again? What if the path Seraph wants us to take enables us to hold on to higher values with more stability? One thing is obvious. For the first time in history, we have a chance to steal fire from the gods. To turn away from it now, to stop pursuing a future in which technology and biology combine, leading to the promise of a singularity, would mean to deny the very essence of who we are. No doubt the road to get there will be bumpy, hurting some people along the way. But won't achieving the dream be worth it? We can become the gods we've always been striving to be. We might as well get good at it.
One of the limitations about myth and image and emotional reactions is that there's a whole variety of storylines that are being put out there. And so just because you get an emotional reaction doesn't mean that it's automatically the good direction to be going in, that we need to examine it. So what's the image of the world that this particular clip from the video game is portraying? What's it offering there? What's it drawing us towards? Any ideas? Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's in a modern technological form of media giving us the same story that the Greek myths were giving, that we can become gods. Yeah, in the back? Sorry, can you shout that out a bit louder? Yeah, that we have this choice to become something greater, which is implying that, you know, what we are right now is not all that there is. So there is, again, this sense of something beyond us, something going further. But the other thing that is interesting there, that there's an acknowledgement, but I'm afraid there's going to be some bumps on the road. We're going to have to, you know, smash some people as we go along, and that's a bummer, but we'll get over that. So you can kind of get a sense of the vision that's being put out there, but we still need to really evaluate that and to really reflect on that. And so this is where I want to kind of go on to kind of think about, well then, as Christians, how can or should we be engaging with the arts? What might we be able to do in the way of really bringing our ideas into bear in this whole area? This is Bono from the group U2 that you might not recognize him without his sunglasses. But he, on Irish TV 2 weeks ago, gave an interview with one of our kind of well-known presenters. And he was very clear about his faith in this movie, or in this documentary, in ways that he hasn't often been in the past. But what he was also asked about is, well, kind of, what does it mean for him as a Christian to be making music? What is it that they're trying to do? And I think I'd like to have us listen to a few minutes of this. I didn't want to depend on having to stream it, so I've just pulled out a little bit of it. So what he's just been asked about is to reflect on the early days of U2 when they were trying to make a decision about how to engage with their Christian faith. And he refers to one of the other band members, Edge, for those of you that aren't familiar with them all and all their names. And the other thing he's asked about that you may need to know about is Mount Temple, and that was the name of the high school that all of the guys in the band went to, and that's when they first started to get together.
Yeah, what was that?
Well, there was there are revivals, you've probably, I mean, you read about them, and it's just people are moved, and at that time, 76, 77, a lot of things were happening. You had Bob Dylan's conversion to Christianity. So something was stirring, let's put it that way. And it was happening in Mount Temple a little bit. And then, whilst we were on this kind of Lipton Village, surreal, gang-banging trip, we bump into some people who seem to have a real, you know, deep faith. And there was a fellow called Chris Rowe who ran a Christian meeting called Shalom. And this fellow really understood the scriptures, and he could really unlock them. And I'd always been fascinated by the scriptures. I mean, you can't be a fan of the blues, or you can't be a fan of Bob Dylan or folk music and not really understand the scriptures a bit. So we became very interested in this. And they, at first, appeared to appreciate that we were different and didn't want us to change the way we looked. But then it started to dawn on us that, in the end, they thought that rock and roll was a kind of a distraction from what was really going on in a broken world. And it sort of crescendoed with Edge leaving the band. It was Edge and me, but he said to me, "So, you know, it's right. You know, there's really, the world is a broken place, and there's a lot of broken lives, and this is really not the way to go about anything useful with our life, you know." And so we both left the band. So we've already now had our first album is out. It's done very well in the US and elsewhere. Got a big tour. We then go and see Paul McGinnis, the Winston Churchill of rock. And he's sitting there. and they're ready to meet them on the beaches. And and we say, Paul, we're not, you know, we're done. And we actually want to do something useful with our life. And maybe rock and roll isn't it, and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, so God tells you to do this. And we said, no, it's not exactly, but it's very deeply convicted here. He said, would you mind speaking to God about, like, the commitments I've made on your behalf to do another tour? Because I presume that, you know, breaking your contract wouldn't be a, you know...
In accordance with God.
Wouldn't be in accordance with... So we kind of go, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Okay, just one more tour. And so this is our second album, October, and we do that tour for that album. And then... we start to write, and Edge actually starts writing the song Sunday Bloody Sunday, and kind of came at that moment. And whatever happened, somehow we started to realize that our music was the way that we spoke
to it
to the world. Our music, these were prayers of a kind, and what were we doing hanging out with these people who didn't understand this? They'd somehow turned God into a very retail relationship, you know, and you had to, you know, declare it. It had to be something, had to have a Christian sticker on it. I don't understand that. You know, does a tree have a sign up saying made by God? No, it's just, it's there. It declares itself. Creation does. So music does, poetry does, and more importantly, the problem with gospel music is a lot of the time it's in denial of where we're really at. A lot of the time it's trying to brush things under the carpet, which is where the blues comes from. The blues, Robert Johnson, hellhound on my heel, starts to speak the truth. Now, if you know anything about scriptures, you know it's the truth that sets you free. So we started to see this sort of... the lies, and maybe that's too strong a term, that was in gospel music and all this kind of happy clappy stuff. And we started to see that actually the truthfulness of the blues, and of course rock and roll is the combination of the blues and gospel, the highness, the headiness of gospel, and the mud of the Mississippi, of Delta, or indeed the Liffey or the Mersey or whatever it is, that's where the mud and that is where our music really comes from. That moment, that's the fusion, really.
Okay, moving on to 1984 and Bob Geldof.
So that image of taking the music, taking the truth that they experience in the world and bringing it into music is something that I think you two have been amazing at. I remember shortly after we'd moved back to Ireland, I brought my son to a U2 concert. And in the middle of this concert, they have this kind of, okay, time out for a few minutes. We're going to talk about human rights and the plight of the poor in the world. And I was thinking, how can a rock band do this, that they have 100,000 kids screaming their head, well, not just kids, older people too, screaming their heads off, and getting them to reflect about the plight of the poor in other parts of the world? I was thinking, you know, we'd like to get two people to come to our Bible study, but these guys can get 100,000 in to listen to them. And you see then, as Bono himself and some of the other musicians have gone on to be really impactful in getting with world leaders and saying, you guys have got to do something about the status of the world. And this all is deriving from their Christian faith, but it's been added to by the fact that they have some acclaim as musicians. But again, part of it is the way they have used their music to really grab people's attention. And I think the challenge then to the rest of us is to reflect on where has God made us in a way that we can be imaginative and creative and tap into that artistic, passionate side of us and the world, and use that for his glory, as well as the words and the arguments that we have, to really see ourselves completely made the way that we are, and all of that as a way that can be used by God. I think there's all sorts of different ways that we can do this, that different people use all sorts of signposts to say, you know, I've got interests in all sorts of areas, and we can engage, whether it's in pubs or in coffee shops, with people and about their various interests. I'm not going to read all of this, but one of the books that I mentioned that C.S. Lewis was impacted by was by George MacDonald, and he in turn was impacted by this particular book, again another fairy tale. In this story, one of the characters says, "You look with wonder," she said, "upon the many colored, distinct, and curious traces and images upon the old stone slabs. They seem to have always been well known, nor had they been preserved without a reason. You muse and muse, you conjecture single meanings, and become more and more curious to arrive at the deep coherence of these old writings." Even stones that are there can get people to think, why were these things put there? What is it about human nature that they drag these massive boulders across all sorts of miles of territory just to stick them together? What is it all about? That we can get all sorts of insight. If we had time, I was going to have you reflect on a poem that's in the handout, but I'll just leave you to do that later. Again, this is where a Christian poet has put this poem together to, again, encourage people to not just look at a pretty flower, but to actually think about it and reflect about it, and to experience many of the other parts of nature in a way that will lead us and point us back to the Creator. But I want to finish up by just mentioning a couple of things that I think are important to qualify here. C.S. Lewis himself said that conversion requires an alteration of the will, an alteration which in the last resort does not occur without the intervention of the supernatural. He didn't think that emotion and reason and intelligence and imagination was enough to bring somebody to Christ. He says, if the intellectual climate is such that when a man comes to the crisis at which he must either accept or reject Christ, his reason and imagination are not on the wrong side, then his conflict will be fought out under favorable condition. Reason and imagination set the scene, they toil the soil in order then that the person comes to realize, I have to make a choice. Is it Christ or is it not? And that, he said, is where the divine interaction comes, and where he says we need prayer, we need engagement with the Scripture, we need discussion with one another, we need to be really asking God to bring his influence to bear in other people's lives. He also points out in one of his stories, his fictional stories, the Screwtape Letters, where he has the uncle, the elder demon, point out to the trainee demon, Wormwood, that no amount of piety in his imagination and affections will harm us if we can keep it out of his will. So again, imagine, these are the devils strategizing how to influence humans. And he says, let them have all the imagination they want. Let them feel all the sort of stuff that they want to. The issue is about a person's will. The more often he feels without acting, the less he will be able to, ever to act. And in the long run, the less he will be able to feel. So again, the feelings, the thinking are not enough unless we actually go further and make it a matter of the will. And so in the area that where I've kind of developed this model around ethics, and I think it applies fairly well here as well, that we have moral reflection that we're very familiar with. We need to think about these issues and develop arguments. But we also need to be engaging with the feeling side of things, where we're perceiving the moral injustices in the world, or we're perceiving the beauty of the world. And we get a lot of these sensations from the arts and life's experience. We also need to have the spiritual engagement, to have prayer and the Holy Spirit's work in all of this. And then the one point that I just want to mention very briefly to conclude is that behavior is also very important. And as an example in this area, in one of the courses I teach at the university, it's on spirituality and health. And I asked the students to write an essay, because at the same time as taking my course, they're required to do some volunteer work in any setting that they choose. And I asked him to write an essay about the spiritual implications of this volunteering activity that they do. And at first, they're like, what on earth are you talking about? It's not that I'm not going and praying with people in hospital, or I'm not going and doing something religious. I'm just going serving the poor, or I'm going helping some older people learn computer skills or something like that. And I say, no, think about the bigger issues of life. Think about what this is telling you about the meaning of life, about what's important to people and what's important about people's lives. And so I just come up with the assignment, and I was astonished at some of the responses that I got from some of the students. So, for example, one of them says, after thinking about this experience, I think I will question my faith more. I will think about my actions instead of just doing them out of habit. I don't want to go through my life half believing in something. So again, just getting people to think about their actions and their activities can sometimes get people into some of these spiritual discussions. Another student says, I felt very humbled by this incident, and it led me to question my own set of moral values. Here was this man who had nothing but the clothes on his back, showing such compassion for other people. Instead, I was the selfish one, consumed by greed, as society had led me to become. The poor, such as the homeless, are prophets and teachers who can shout at us about our selfishness, our greed, and our materialism. I think this person is moving along towards the Lord, and it's simply come about by my asking them to reflect on the feelings that they got as they did this volunteer service. So to finish up then, a few points of application that I would like to conclude on. First of all, where are our hearts being drawn? We are getting emotional feeding in various ways from all sorts of stuff around us. Are we reflecting on that? Are we noticing the way I'm being drawn into hours and hours of Call of Duty or car racing or whatever it is, or lots and lots of music? Are we reflecting on the way this is impacting on our hearts? Do we reflect on that? Do we discuss it? Do we say to our friends, you know, why is it that I love to spend hours and hours and hours on this stuff, and yet I can't spend 5 minutes talking to you? Let's talk about that. Do we engage emotionally, imaginatively, and creatively with our friends, or are we just doing the same old stuff all the time? Do we think about these dimensions to their lives and how we can connect with them? Do we ask them, you know, what is it about that music or that activity that you really love? And maybe I can start to learn a little bit about that too. Are we developing our own emotional, imaginative, and creative responses? You know, you think about John Lennox this morning. I'm sure he spent lots of times thinking about those stories, about those images that helped us to relate to the fact that these are complicated mathematical issues, and yet he's put them in a way that we can really connect with. How are we doing that with those around us? Because, you know, we probably are not going to be interested in all of the same sorts of things, and likewise they're not, but how can we engage with them? And then in order to do that, do you know about how God has gifted you in the areas of emotional understanding or imaginative developments or creative things? You know, have you that sense that God gave me this side of my interests or this creative side to me? And how can I develop that and use that for him just as much as I want to use my head and my hands and the other areas of my life? So those are the things that I wanted to talk about. And I know I've used up all our time, but I'm happy to stay here and take any questions that anybody may have. Or if you've got suggestions for me about Donald, you got to watch this film because it's really good on this thing, or you got to listen to this song, feel free to send it to me, and I'd love to hear about those extra ways. So thank you very much for your attention, and look forward to bumping into you over the rest of the conference.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.